welcome to the Dark Side of Soul podcast. This is Joe.
This is Sean.
And we want to thank you for sacrificing your time to be with us, human.
Thank you for your sacrifice. Thank you for
it.
Your...
That was it. There we go. The whole show's over. We did it.
Yeah. See you next week.
Yeah. No, today we're talking about human sacrifice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Time.
It's the holidays, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's Easter.
True.
Yeah.
True. Yeah. But, you know, you do get the frankincense and myrrh for embalming the body.
I mean, they did have to hide. They had to keep Jesus hidden because they were getting rid of all the firstborn sons, all the sons.
Oh, yeah.
Those weren't really sacrifices, but they were just weeding out. But
possible challenges to Herod's rule.
Yeah.
That reminds me. One of my favorite Christmas TV episode is from the British show Vicar of Dibley. Mm-hmm. They had a few Christmas shows, but this one is particular. So the people of the village, they're putting on a Christmas play, and you know the rich aristocrat is stuck playing Herod, and he doesn't want to play Herod because doesn't want to be the bad guy. And so, you know, it's his line. It goes, go out and kill all the firstborn boys out in the land. And they go, yes, sir. And he goes, but kill them gently. I love that line. Yeah. I love that line.
I haven't seen that in a long time. I don't think I've seen that since it was on TV.
It's a tradition that I watch in the 90s. I do have to watch that every year. It's such a funny, crazy episode. I love that.
Oh, like a Christmas viewing tradition?
Yeah, for me it is. No one ever watches it with me. No one ever watches any Christmas stuff with me. I'm just by myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually the same. My tradition, I think I've mentioned this before, is Mr. Bean Christmas. Hey,
that's a good one. Yeah, that's one of my traditions as well.
Yeah, and I watched half of the New Year's episode, because the second half is good, but it's the one where he goes shopping on New Year's Day. He gets a chair for cheap and he puts it on the top of his car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then he paints, and then it all ends up, but in the end, I think that's the same episode. Or, you know, he gets all the stuff to like paint his apartment, then he just puts, he explodes the paint can to paint his apartment. And it links back to the guys that were at his New Year's Eve party before, and they bailed on him. They tricked him and left. So anyway, traditions. But we're talking about the tradition of the human sacrifice.
Yeah.
Because it was a tradition. It was cultural. It had a lot of, there was a lot of value placed on it. It wasn't done for, it wasn't just done out of spite or being bad. It was all over the world. It had a lot of value placed on it in different cultures. So now I've found, tell me if, I don't know if you've found this as well, but have you found that generally, say years ago anyway,
mm-hmm.
that it was often rejected? I remember asking people in the past, a long time ago, Koreans, if there was human sacrifice in Korea. And they're like, no, we didn't. Our ancestors didn't sacrifice people. And I was like, that seems weird. It seems strange that there wouldn't have been any sacrifice. But I was like, okay. And then I looked into it and I was like, yeah, no, there very likely was. And then especially with the advancement of archaeology, the growth of archaeology in Korea since the 80s, especially, more and more discoveries are being made that just counter what is often, I think, like semi-popular thought. And that, yeah, there were no sacrifices in Korea. Yeah, completely untrue. Completely untrue. There were definitely sacrifices, and we're going to dive in and have a look at some of these. So kind of a brief breakdown first. So human sacrifice I mean, now in retrospect, is viewed as kind of barbaric. And but from the perspective of the people that were doing it, like I said, there was, they put value on it. There was cultural value, spiritual, religious value as well. So a lot of this, a lot of this is, our views are in retrospect, not the best. We would reject human sacrifice today because we don't have any value on it. But no, our ancestors, yeah, no, they did value it. And it's also kind of viewed as having been very uncommon. But and some Korean media has even suggested there's no evidence for it in the past in Korea. But we know that's untrue. There's archaeologists in Korea have known for decades that there was sacrifice in Korea. And it was far more common across cultures than we think. And there were various reasons for it. So, for example, probably the most well-known or among the most well-known cultures to have performed human sacrifice were the Aztec. And it's widely believed to have been religious, to appease gods. But there have been arguments made that human sacrifice may have been linked to cannibalism. There was a lack of food and proteins, and so people were sacrificed to provide food for a growing population. So these arguments have been made since at least the 70s, and there is support for it. Rome, of course, committed human sacrifices. Very famously, the Forum Boarium in Rome in 215 BCE or BC, there were 4 sacrifices made at the Forum Boarium to appease God. So it was religious. In Korea, all across the peninsula, through the various kingdoms that were here in the past, it was also likely linked to spiritual beliefs, but also for, and we'll get into this, a specific type of human sacrifice was to provide servants to elites in the afterlife. So, that's the kind of the key point that we're going to get into today. And what's interesting about that, though, is that it really indicated the rise of an elite class. People were willing to be sacrificed for someone they have viewed as a more powerful authority figure. So the growth of the elite classes really is exemplified by human sacrifice. But also interesting, human sacrifices have been outlawed for a long time. Rome outlawed or banned human sacrifices, I think in like the year 90 BCE, something like that, over 2,000 years ago, a very, very long time. So by the time Jesus allegedly lived, human sacrifices were outlawed. And we'll get more into more specifically how all this relates to Korea. So human sacrifices can be found, evidence of human sacrifice can be found throughout Korea, like I said, the different dynasties. So pre-unified Silla. And I think a lot of things that's key to remember about Korea is that pre-unified Silla, so pre-mid to late 7th century, Korea was, the peninsula consisted of several kingdoms. There's basically the three kingdoms, and then the other, like confederacies and things like that. So these were the states that ruled the peninsula, and then the unified Silla was the really, and I hear a lot of Korean historians argue that is really the beginning of Korea as we know it. Really starts in the 7th century when Silla is unified. Things become more cohesive. The peninsula itself is one unit. So things really start then. But before this time, there were human sacrifices in just the Shilla dynasty. So before the unified Shilla. So this was in what is today kind of the east southeastern part of the peninsula. Its famous capital was Gyeongju. Mm-hmm. So human sacrifice was conducted there for probably around 200 years. And the type of sacrifice that was common was called Sunjang, which was a royal burial practice. So to understand what this means, what type of human sacrifice it was, it's better to look at the two words, Sunjang.
Sunjang.
Sun, yes. So Jang is burial, the hancha, the root word is burial. Sun, the root word, the hancha, is martyrdom. So burying people with royals. So yeah, sacrifices to the dead, the royal dead. So this is called in English retainer sacrifice. So the retainers, the people who somehow had some connection to the royalty being buried, or not always royalty, it could also be aristocracy, aristocrats. So basically retainer sacrifice is the burial of servants or subordinates with some sort of deceased authority figure, like a king or a queen, or like I said, aristocracy. The general idea was to accompany the dead to the afterlife, and therefore there would often be several retainers sacrificed with one single elite, so they'd have several people with them in the afterlife. So now during this time, it really was only for the highest ranking royalty, of course, and the very highest ranking aristocracy. And most of these sites, the evidence for these sites today can be found in, of course, Gyeongju, in the capital city, which was the central point of the Shilla.
Yeah.
But also today in Busan and Daegu, two of the very popular tourism sites.
Yeah.
But other places as well, like Yeongdeok and whatnot. Totaling around the old Shilla region, 56 grave sites where Sunjang evidence has been uncovered. So, and for anyone just wondering why Seoul is not part of that, it's because Seoul was not part of Shilla. Seoul was not connected to Shilla. And so that's why there you won't find these around the Seoul area today. You only find Shilla hotels. That's it. That's all you find. And I hope there's no human sacrifices in Shilla bread. Watch somebody turn that into a soundbite. The dark side of Seoul guys have said Shilla bakery sacrifices people into its bread. So that's a very basic breakdown of Sunjang, the type of sacrifice that was common throughout Shilla. So, but who were they? Who were the people sacrificed? If you asked most people, Stu, I don't know if you've looked through the notes yet.
No,
but if I ask you generally to guess or assume the type of people that would have been sacrificed, like their social standing, their social class or whatnot, what generally would you assume?
I would assume they'd be slaves.
Slaves, right. And I think that's generally what most people would say. Yeah. However, we'll get into that. There's evidence that kind of helps us understand who they were or who a lot of them were. So first of all, during Shilla, the majority of people who were martyred in Sunjang were men and women aged between 20, 21 years old and 35 years old. That was the most common age group. And this has been seen or can be observed most commonly in two ancient cemeteries called the Imdang and Joyeong. These two cemeteries give evidence to a lot of the Sunjang that the elements of Sunjang that we know about. Now, the grave goods, the things that are buried with the dead, this is extremely important for understanding who people were in graves. Now, grave goods in Korean are called myeonggi, and these are items that are buried with the dead. And they do generally, like I said, indicate social status or position. So yes, some of the people who were sacrificed in Sunjang, the Sunjang rituals, had no myeonggi. They were buried with nothing. So probably indicating that they had very little social standing.
Right.
So possibly slaves, or very low anyway. But other ones had iron items, like swords and farming tools.
Mm-hmm.
So this indicates that, in some way it can suggest anyway, that a lot of the people sacrificed in Sunjang worked for whoever's buried at the gravesite, the owner of the main occupant of the grave.
Mm-hmm.
They were connected to them in some way. There would have been servants, guards, soldiers, land managers. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Land managers, farmers, soldiers, like if they were bodyguards in the afterlife.
See, that makes sense. I mean, because, you know, you don't want anyone to be killed in the afterlife.
Well, that's the way they viewed it. So, and we can see not too dissimilar, really, from the terracotta warriors.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And lots of cultures have done that. Right. You know, Egypt, sure. India,
mm-hmm.
has done that. You know, brought the others with them into the afterlife.
Right. So not always slaves. So I think generally, if you ask people that question, what would they assume? They would say, oh, it was slaves.
Yeah,
but
they're
no.
property to them in their minds. Yeah.
Right. But no. There's evidence indicating otherwise, at least in a lot of situations. Another interesting thing, though, is that some of the people sacrificed in the Sunjang were buried with gold and other items.
Oh.
So their myeonggi consists of things made of gold, silver, there's jewelry, jade, items made of jade, like jade earrings, and bracelets, and whatnot. And this is very similar to the myeonggi for the elites, the people, the main occupants of a gravesite. So a lot of the Sunjang sacrifices had the same or similar myeonggi as the main occupant.
Mm.
And then that indicates that they had higher social standing, quite high in several cases. What's also interesting is that there's evidence that a lot of the people who were buried with the main dead also were given funeral rites. So they also then were considered to be very important. So the entire process had a deep culture surrounding it. So again, this is just more evidence that a lot of the people sacrificed with the main dead were also elites. So we can infer this from the myeonggi, but there has been evidence collected through DNA analysis that a lot of the people who were buried with the elites were directly related to the elites themselves.
Mm.
So a lot of the Sunjang sacrifices, the retainers, were related to the dead. So, and the DNA showed that they were related almost always on their mother's side. So interesting.
Oh.
So, yeah. So it kind of just breaks down the idea that slaves were always buried with the dead. Definitely not always the case, at least in Silla. So now Sunjang, like I said, it probably went on for about 200 years, but by the early 6th century, around the year 502, the king who was in power, King Jijong, banned Sunjang.
Mm-hmm.
So he banned it, but there were other factors going on at the time that kind of helped to stop it. The same king, Jijong, also standardized a lot of the funeral traditions. Like he standardized funeral garb, the kind of clothing, mourning clothing that you would have to wear at a funeral. All that was standardized, and that really shifted some of the economy behind funerals. Now, that's a really deep subject, and we're not going to go into that now, but the shifting of the economy may have also impacted it. But also Buddhism. Buddhism became the state religion in the following king, King Bupung. So when King Bupung made Buddhism the state religion, this may have influenced the general opinion about human sacrifice. And then that also helped to kind of stop it. So even though it was banned, it was made illegal by Jijong in 502, other factors were involved. And one of the factors may have been religion, Buddhism. However, even though all this was going on, we do know that there are graves that post-date the banning of Sunjang that do show evidence of retainer sacrifice. So people were breaking the law. And so so it was still going on. So it, you know, law doesn't mean anything. If people want to do something, people will just do it. And it was still carried out until it really impacted the broader cultural thinking of the population. And then it just slowly stopped.
Mm.
So, but what's interesting is that the overall, the banning and then just the slow ceasing of Sunjang may have given rise to another type of myeonggi, grave goods. And this is burying people with dolls shaped like humans.
Yeah.
Like the mokyong, which is a wooden doll, and the doyong, a clay doll. So the idea was that these people still needed servants of some sort in the afterlife, couldn't bury them with actual humans anymore. And so they created this cultural idea of burying them with items that looked like humans. So maintaining the idea, but changing how the idea is conducted, how it's actually done. And so a lot of cultural shifts happened right around that time. And maybe as a result of the dropping of Sunjang, and then that particular practice of burying the dead with human shaped dolls continued for a long time. I mean, there's evidence of it throughout the Joseon dynasty as well. And so, which is quite a long period later, quite a long time after. So that's just the basic breakdown of Sunjang and how it was done. Now, there are some other examples outside of Shilla that are worth mentioning. And these are sites that are easy to visit. So I mentioned how the Three Kingdoms period was, you know, and pre-unified Shilla had a lot of, you know, other ideas and thoughts, cultures. There's the different kingdoms, the confederacies. So one of them was Gaya.
The mythical Gaia.
Gaia, yes. Historians do a lot of research on it, but Gaia seems to be one of the regions of ancient Korea that isn't discussed very much by people.
Nope. People forget it ever existed.
Yeah. So it's not considered one of the Three Kingdoms.
That would make it four.
That's right. So it's often viewed as a confederacy. Mm-hmm. And so things are different there. But so if you really want to look into something for the listeners, if you really want to look into something about old Korea that a lot of people don't know very much about, study Gaia. Look, there's a lot of research online that you can find. There are experts on it. We do know quite a bit about it, but it's just not very popular. But if you do come to Korea, or if you're in Korea and you want to visit something that's really interesting about Gaia, there are ancient tombs there. And they are in Gimhae. Now, Gimhae is not too far from Busan. So that's where they, if you fly into Busan, you actually fly into Gimhae. That's where the airport is. And so in an area of Gimhae called Daesangdong, there are grave mounds there. And these grave mounds date to about the late 3rd century. And men and horses were buried with the dead. So indicating that Gaia, separate from Shilla, also conducted human sacrifices. Mm-hmm. Now, that particular grave site, the ancient tombs of Gaia, is a domestic historic site, of course. 30 years ago, it was designated. But just this year, 2023, in September, when they announced it, UNESCO announced that the ancient tombs of Gaia are now a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Good.
So Gaia is finally getting a bit of love. So, but back to Shilla. I wanted to mention Gaia because it's important. But yeah. Going back to Shilla, there is a place that's very well known in Gyeongju that's called the Wolsong and the Moon Castle. A lot of people translate it as. So it was likely built in the 4th century. Took about 50 to 70 years or so to build. It is important to note that older records tell us that it was built way sooner, more than like 200 years earlier. But modern evidence shows that that's very likely not the case. It was built very likely in the 4th century. Now, I mean, like, it's ruins now. If you were to go visit there, you're not going to see a palace, because it's considered a palace fortress. But if you go there, you're not going to see anything like that. You're going to see ruins. And there was really from the mid 1980s, there was an increase in the archaeological research of the area. And in 1985, they did a test dig and they found human remains. Then 5 years later, they started doing more digging in the site. They found more human remains. In total, in those two digs, they found the remains of 20 humans, and all very likely human sacrifices. Now, this is different from Sundang, because Sundang was retainer sacrifice. People buried with the dead. These people were buried at a construction site, at a site for a palace, a fortress palace, indicating that it was believed that burying them there, sacrificing them while under construction, the site being under construction, helped with the actual building of the site. And it would help with the foundation, and the structure of the wall would maintain its integrity and things like that. So there was a spiritual value added to this. It made sense to them. Now, it wasn't really until 2017 that more remains were found, and very strongly indicating that human sacrifice took place there. Human remains were found at the Western Wall. It was two people. It was a man and a woman. There was no sign of struggle. Very likely human sacrifice. And animal bones were also found with them on the site. So again, a sacrifice. And again, highlighting how different this was from Sundang, from the retainer sacrifice. And then a few years later in 2021, they found even more remains there. They found the remains of a woman around the Western Wall area. And again, a sacrifice. What's interesting is that she was wearing very elaborate clothing and jewelry. So she may have been an elite who was sacrificed for the integrity of this new palace fortress that they were building.
Okay.
Very, very interesting. So, yeah, so those are some of the historic examples of human sacrifices that we can find in Korea. And chances are good, as archaeology continues to look for these things, they're going to find more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are other stories of human sacrifice that generally doesn't have any. They're stories more than history.
Right.
And this is a famous one. I think we talked about this.
We have talked about it, but it doesn't hurt to talk about it again.
No,
so much content. I don't expect people to be filing through everything to pick out this one.
right. So yeah, it's the Imele bell, the sacred bell of King Sunduk. So this was a bell. Now, first of all, I'll say that Korean bell makers were very well respected in the past.
Right.
The Korean bell craft was very, very high quality. It was respected, revered, and that's why a lot of them still exist. So, and this is one of them, the sacred bell of King Sunduk, was built in sometime around the late 8th century, or in 770, 771, around that time. There was a king, Kyungduk, that wanted to build the bell in honor of his father, the previous king, Sunduk. So he commissioned for the bell to be made. And, you know, it's quite old. You know, today it's a national treasure, and you can go visit it. It still exists. It's on public display in Gyeongju at the National Museum. So one of the most important historic relics in Korea. So, and it's easy to see. So go check it out. But there's an interesting legend about the casting of the bell. And Joe, do you share this on your tour?
No, not at all.
No. Okay. I used to, when I had a different route. And I only started sharing it because during the Buddhist Lantern Festival one year, which is down in Cheonggyecheon.
Oh, I remember what you're talking about. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, they had one of the lanterns was in the shape of the Sunduk bell, the divine bell. And so I had it as a bonus story that year. That was part of my route. I walked down there and I told everyone, I was like, oh, that's the Sunduk bell. And so I shared a bonus story with them. And then I kept it on for about 6 months or so. And then I changed my route. So I don't share it at all now on the Dark Side tour, but
yeah, we switched things around a bit.
Yeah. So there are different variations of the legend, but basically the one that I first heard and the one that I tend to like the most, the variation I like the most is that, the king died. Now we know this. King Kyungduk, who commissioned the bell, he died. He never saw the bell.
Mm-hmm.
He died 5 or so years before the bell was completed. And it was said that when he died, they finished the bell. And when they struck it, it didn't make a sound.
Right.
And they're like, oh, crap. Okay, well, we've done something wrong. So let's melt this back down, put this back in the smelter and see what we can do. And they tried it again. It didn't work. It didn't sound good, or it just didn't make a good enough vibrant sound, the sound that they were looking for, especially a bell that was being constructed for a king.
Mm-hmm.
And then apparently one of the variations, monks were going around collecting things for the bell. Collecting bronze or, you know, things like that, things to put into the casting of the bell from the people in Gyeongju. And a monk went to a house, knocked on the door. He's collecting items. And the woman who answered the door, she answered holding a baby. And she started to mock the monk, saying, what? Oh, you monks, you're always looking for something. The government's always looking for something from us, the people. Of course, I don't have anything to donate. I'm poor. I have nothing to give you for the casting of this bell. The only thing I have of value is my baby. Do you want my baby? And so the monk realized, that she was mocking him. And so he apologized and he left. That night, the same monk had a dream, a solution to the problem why they couldn't get the bell to make any sound. The solution that he dreamt about was if they threw a child into the smelting pit while casting the bell, that would help with the sound once it was cast, because the spirit of the child would permeate throughout the casting, and then they would make a sound. So the monk got up early the next morning, rushed down to the woman's house, knocked on the door, and she's like, "Oh, you're back." And he's like, "Yes, I am back." And he said, "Do you know how you said yesterday, the only thing you had a value to give and you would give it would be your child mocking me?" He said, "Yeah, well, I want your child." Different variations of how she gives up the child. He takes the child and have a big ritual, big ceremony. They toss the child, sacrifice the child into the smelting pit. They cast the bell, they ring it, and it makes the most beautiful sound. And the sound that comes out of the bell, emanates from the bell, sounds like imele, imele, which was at the time, apparently, allegedly, a Shilla word for mother. And it was believed that the spirit of the child was crying for its mother every single time the bell was rung. And then that is the legend behind the bell, how it was cast with the body of a child thrown into the pit. Mm-hmm. Now, there's no evidence for this. It's only a legend. And some people believe it's actually might even be modern. It might be 20th century. It might be mixed up with other stories. It just kind of, it's been other stories that have similar motifs and whatnot eventually made its way into this legend. But, you know, it's a story. You never let history get in the way of a good story. Mm-hmm. So it's a story. But we do know that child sacrifices were conducted in the Shilla dynasty. So in the late 90s, they found the remains of a well. And in the bottom of this well, they found the bones of a boy, very likely a young boy, face down, very likely a sacrifice, because with him were animal bones and pottery, other offerings. So a child was thrown into this well as a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And it's believed very, very likely that the reason the child was thrown into the well as a sacrifice was to appease spirits of the well, because they were going to close the well. The well was being shut down, was going to be covered over. And in order to appease the spirits of the well, they gave the spirits offerings, pottery, animals, in a human child. And that's no legend. So there you go. That's some breakdown of human sacrifices.
Wow.
In Korea.
Do we have any recommendations today?
Movie? Oh yeah, we haven't done this. Joe and I were talking as we just before we started recording. It hit me. It's like, I haven't given movie recommendations in.
You mentioned Children of the Corn. I'll put that in there.
Yeah. So I know movies off the top of my head. I didn't write them down on the notes, but
write them down.
Yeah. So I haven't given movie recommendations in months. So yeah, there are lots of movies that talk about human sacrifice. One that popped in my head was Children of the Corn, another one is, and don't you say it, The Wicker Man, and the original Wicker Man.
Yeah. Not the bees!
Not the fucking remake. God damn it. I hate that movie. The original. Brilliant.
I'll write down the original. Okay.
Yeah. The original Wicker Man, of course. That's 1973, if you want to put the year, because the remake is 2005 or 6 or something. Okay. Yeah, so The Wicker Man. The Wicker Man. More modern ones, too. Midsommar has Midsommar. Human sacrifice. Yeah, okay. Midsommar. Also, Hereditary involves some sacrifice. And what are some other ones? Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
That's not a horror
That's
film.
That's a big one.
Yeah. There's a lot. There's just a lot. The Ritual a few years ago. The Ritual, Netflix. It's on Netflix. The Ritual. That's a good human sacrifice movie. Yeah, there's just so many that involve human sacrifice. Oh, what's that called? What's that called? A mother. Mother with an exclamation point.
Mother. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. With Aronofsky. Mm-hmm. Yeah. With what's her name? Jennifer Lawrence is in that. Yeah. That's a human sacrifice.
Think about the cabin in the woods is.
Cabinet. Yes. Yeah. That's like essentially a sacrificing for research. Suspiria. Suspiria is a sacrifice film as well. The original one. I didn't finish the remake, although the remake is very popular, but the original Dario Argento, Suspiria, 1977. Fantastic film. So there you go. That'll do.
Enough. I think we got enough.
Yeah, that's enough. That's enough. Yeah. So, yeah. So there you go. I'll start getting back. And I stopped for a few episodes. It was kind of inappropriate, I think, because of our content. Mm-hmm. And then I just kind of forgot to get back into it.
Hmm.
So
it's all right. Yeah. Have you got any listener mail for us?
Another thing we've been forgetting about adding, been really bad about this. We still get, we always get reviews of the tours and people send us messages and whatnot on Instagram. I normally, if people message us on Instagram, I generally respond directly to them. But yes, if you do send us something from now, we're going to remember to read them out on the podcast. So send us a note.
At darksideofsoul.com.
Yes, you send it right there.
Info@darksideofsoul.com.
Yeah, that's right. And don't forget, we do have, that's right, that email address as well. And so so the listener mail is a review of the tour. And I want to read this one specifically. This is from a woman named Doreen. She and her friend joined the tour back in November. And she said, "We chose a very cold night, so we had to cut it short. We enjoyed the time sharing the stories with him, with the guide. We were too cold to feel the ghosts, but we had the warmth of our guide." Very sweet. And I wanted to share this in particular because Doreen and her friend were very sweet Chinese Australians who joined us. And it was really cold. And they were the only ones that booked the extended tour that night. And there were four or five other people, and it was cold, and then they had other things going on, or they just didn't want to, they were too cold to continue. So they decided not to pay the extra and stay on the extended. So everyone else left, but Doreen and her friend also said they're quite old, they're elderly. And they said, "We're freezing. So can we do something else?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure. You got me for one more hour." So took them to a nearby coffee shop. And we sat down. Three of us got something warm to drink. And I just shared Korean ghost lore and legends and folk traditions with them. And they told me a lot about their own traditions and whatnot that they heard from their parents growing up in China when they were young. And so it was great. And a great night. So that's something that we'll do sometimes. If the weather's particularly bad, we can shift it a little bit and go inside.
I've told it. We've had some small groups lately. We had some extremely cold nights, and I've
said, and this week is going to be nuts.
Just tell me if you're too cold, we can duck into a place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Your comfort's our priority.
Yeah. Yeah. And, the first time I did this was several years ago because I had one person on the tour, and the air quality was really bad this one night. We had horrible. We had all these warnings, and it was so bad you could taste it. It was in the air. It was disgusting. And so I showed up, and I said to the person on the tour, it's just you. If you like, we can walk. I'll take you like for the first 30 or 40 minutes of the tour. And she had the extended tour booked. I said, if you want, we'll go inside and we can continue in a coffee shop to get out of this bad air. And she said, yeah, please. That would be great. So I really, really want to do the tour, but if we could just do a little bit like what you said, and then hear some stories and stuff from you sitting down inside, that's perfect. So that's what we did. Last winter was really cold. We had a couple of times I did that. This week is going to be freezing. We were getting back into a big cold snap this week.
Yep.
So we'll see.
There we go. So that was on another report.
There you go. So that's it. There we are.
All right. So
we won't sacrifice you to the cold gods.
No, try not to. Pointing out that you can get our comic. We do have our comic books, volume 1 and volume 2. You can get them online. You can order a physical copy or an electronic copy. If you're in Seoul, you can also go to Dyson Comics Cafe near Jeonghampyeon Station. The Dark Side of Seoul podcast is produced by Joe McPherson and Sean Morrissey. Our opening and closing music is by Soreksam, which you can find on Bandcamp under Jeju Digital. We'd like to thank our top tier patrons, Angel Earl, Joel Bonamini, Sharon Cullen, Devin Hifner, Minsuk Lee, Gabby Palomino, Steve Marsh, Mitchie Brewer, Ron Chang, Mackenzie Moore, Hunter Winter, Cecilia Lufgren-Dumas, Emily Umba, Josephine Reedberg, David Weatherly, and Janice Song. Thank you so much for joining us, for supporting us, and making this possible. If you too want to join this just very motley group, you can just go to patreon.com/darksideofseoul. And starting at just $5 a month, you can get a lot of extra content. And that's fine if you just want to just go in, just look around a bit. You don't have to stick around. But if you like it, stick around. You get extra content that we don't get on the podcast. Anyway, stay safe out there. Until next time, stay spooky.
Good night.